Blog Talk Radio.
We are politics related, so every year on Martin Luther King Day we do a little something about Dr. Martin Luther King. I do have a segment about him coming up a little bit later in the show. I think a lot of people have off today, right? I think it's probably most people, but anyway, a lot of stuff to get to, a lot of big news. We have Donald Trump talking about the issue of Big Pharma. We have more stories about how he's stiffing people, and you can make a sex joke out of that, but I won't. I'll leave that up to your imagination. We have a new report from Oxfam, which, just forget it. It's unbelievable. It's like we're living in a sci-fi novel. That's how bad it is. Oxfam gave us new numbers on wealth inequality, and it's just ridiculous. So I'll spend a decent amount of time on that. Cory Booker, the golden child of hedge funds. Oh boy. So I got some specifics on just how much he's beloved among that group of people. And later on in the show, we're going to go to a little clip from that Paul Ryan town hall that CNN did the other day. You know me. Normally I wouldn't give a flying fuck about that, but there's a very telling moment in there that I feel like we should discuss. So, without further ado, let's get started here, and we're going to shoot right on over to Donald Trump and talk about him and Bernie Sanders. So Donald Trump said something to reporters last week about Big Pharma that I wanted to share with everybody. He said the following: "We have to create new bidding procedures for the drug industry because they're getting away with murder. Pharma has a lot of lobbies, a lot of lobbyists, and a lot of power. We're the largest buyer of drugs in the world, and yet we don't bid properly. And we're going to start bidding and save billions of dollars." So let's be crystal clear. That is a flat-out liberal thing to say. He is making a liberal argument. And this is why, you know, I've been arguing since the beginning, and many others on the left have been arguing since the beginning. It's not enough to simply say, we are the resistance, and we are opposing Donald Trump. Because if you oppose everything he says, then every now and then you're going to look like a jackass. Because sometimes, for example, he'll say, we're going to do infrastructure. We're going to stop spending all the money overseas, and we're going to start rebuilding stuff at home. We're going to stop going into countries and nation building when we don't have to do it, and we're going to do stuff here at home. We're going to save Social Security. We're not going to cut Social Security. We're not going to cut Medicare. So if you play the role of loyal reactionary opposition, every now and then you will be taking the conservative side, which is why you have to be intelligent and rational and actually policy-focused when you're jousting with somebody like Donald Trump, who's a complete and utter wild card, and every now and then says something reasonable. So Huffington Post took this quote, and they asked Bernie Sanders about this, and they said, hey man, what's your take? So Bernie said the following, quote, you know what? He's right, and I've been saying that for years. Pharma does get away with murder, literally murder. People die because they can't get the prescription drugs they need. Sometimes he, talking about Trump, copies my statements. I don't know if he got that one from me. He said something else about pharma, having a number of lobbyists. It's true. Pharma does have lobbyists all over the country, not just in Washington. These people are horrific. They just spent $130 million in California to defeat legislation that would lower prescription drug prices. So it's not enough to just oppose Donald Trump. You have to hold Donald Trump accountable. And Bernie went on the floor of the Senate the other day, and he started showing Donald Trump tweets. And he was like, hey, man, look at the thing you said about Medicare and Social Security, that you're not going to cut it, and that all the other people in the GOP field want to cut it, but you're better than that. And that sometimes, like, Mike Huckabee started copying Trump's rhetoric on saving Social Security and Medicare. And he was like, nope, I'm the one who did it first, and that's what I'm going to do. So, okay, you do know that your little Republican minions are going in the opposite direction. You do know that they are trying to cut. They're working on plans right now. The people Trump appointed to be in the Social Security Administration, they're in favor of cutting and privatizing. So you have to hold him accountable for the stuff that he says. And, by the way, media, where the fuck are you? So here's what happened. Bernie Sanders just proposed an amendment that said, let's import drugs from Canada. And the reason why is they pay significantly less for the same goddamn drugs. And the reason they pay less is they have an independent board that negotiates with the drug companies for better prices. Now, in the U.S., by law, we're not allowed to negotiate with the drug companies for better prices, so they just price gouge the fuck out of us. So Canada pays much less for the same drugs. So Bernie says, okay, let's import those drugs and let's save money, and therefore people can actually get their medication, and they don't have to risk maybe dying. So the amendment failed with 46 votes in favor. It was a weird vote because 12 Republicans flipped and voted with Bernie, including Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and John McCain, and you had corporate Democrats flip and vote with the bulk of Republicans, like Chris Coons from Delaware and Cory Booker and a bunch of other asshat establishment Democrats. But you would think that with Donald Trump just recently saying pharma's getting away with murder, and Bernie Sanders' amendment to crack down on Big Pharma failing, you would think somebody in the media would go up to Donald Trump and say, hey, man, do you support Bernie Sanders' amendment, yes or no? I want you on the record. Do you support Bernie Sanders' amendment, yes or no? You just said they're getting away with murder. This is a way to crack down on them and get better drug prices for the American people. Do you support it, yes or no? We're going to get you on the record. Don't wiggle out of it. Do you support it, yes or no? I want a yes or no answer. Do you support Bernie Sanders' amendment? And if you do, why haven't you gone out there and tweeted about it? Why haven't you gone out there and given an official statement about it? Why haven't you used the bully pulpit because you're the president-elect and you're about to be the president? Why haven't you spoken out on it in that sense? So this is, if the media was doing its goddamn job, this would be the most obvious thing ever. They wouldn't need a fucking YouTube host to come out here and explain this for them. But they do, because they don't know what the fuck they're doing. How many different outlets are there? How many different mainstream outlets? CBS, ABC, NBC, MSNBC, Fox News, CNN. You know, you go through the list. All these fucking reporters, none of them know anything. None of them can ask that very simple question that's so obvious and laid out right in front of them. So put pressure on them. Say, hey, I thought you supported this. Oh, you don't support it? Then why are you a liar? Why did you say you do support the idea that they're getting away with murder and we need to change it? I guess you were lying. Or if you do support it, okay, where's your public statement in favor of it? Why aren't you cracking skulls? Why aren't you yelling at your own party for the majority of them who decided to vote the wrong way on this? What are you doing? What are you doing? So this is what fucking pisses me off, man. It gets under my skin so much because this media, instead of focusing on things that matter and things that might actually save lives and holding the government accountable and holding politicians accountable, what are they doing? They are talking for a day and a half, 2 days, about Meryl Streep versus Donald Trump. Remember when Kanye West went to the White House? They spoke about that for like 2 days straight. Oh my God, Kanye West. And David Sirota made a great point on Twitter. He said, you do realize that the day before that is the day that he picked ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State, the jackass who said during the campaign, we're going to take the oil, we're going to take the oil, we're going to take the oil, that's what we're going to do, we're going to take the oil. He picks the CEO of ExxonMobil for Secretary of State, and what gets more coverage than that? Kanye West and Donald Trump meeting, because it happened the day after, and it was a diversion. I mean, the idiots in our mainstream media were like, red balloon, balloon, follow the balloons, where are the balloons? You got somebody committing murder in the corner, they're like, balloon, balloon. Hold him accountable. Hold him accountable. Take his statement, show him to him, say, were you lying? Or are you going to stay true to this? Apparently Bernie Sanders is the only one doing that, but we need everybody to do it because this guy's a fucking wild card, and the few times he says good things, he should be made to follow through on those good things. Okay. Now, you already know where we're going now. More Trump and more Trump assholery. Okay. So we covered multiple stories of Donald Trump not paying his bills. There were times during the campaign that stories leaked that years ago he paid illegal immigrants to do his work. Now, this is a guy who, you know, ran a campaign on, we're going to build a wall, we're going to build a wall, and if you're here illegally, you're gone. You're gone. Sad, sad. Well, he's paying illegal immigrants to do a lot of his work. He paid them less than minimum wage. Stay classy there, buddy. An alleged billionaire paying less than minimum wage. He also flat out stiffed a bunch of workers. There was a list, a really long list of people who, small businesses where they did contracting work for him, and then they're like, yeah, he never fucking paid me. And then when they ask Trump about it, they say, well, look, some people do bad work, so, you know, I didn't pay them. They didn't deserve it. They didn't earn it. Pretty sure that's not how it works. So you don't like somebody's work, so I'm just going to stiff you. That's not the way it works. And then furthermore, they even asked him about specific people. Like, oh, what did you think of this contractor? And Trump was like, tremendous, tremendous work. I'd use him again. Then they speak to that contractor. He's like, he owes me $1.5 million. So he's saying I stiffed him because they didn't do well. But then you ask him about specific ones. He's like, tremendous, best worker ever. Oh, I didn't pay them? I'm out. So the guy's just a fucking scumbag. But this story honestly just got even more incredible. So we learned the other week, he's got over $1.5 billion in debt, held mostly on Wall Street to various financial institutions. I mean, that's crazy. You got over $1 billion in debt? That sets up unprecedented conflicts of interest. I mean, I was concerned about it with Hillary Clinton. I should have been equally concerned about it with Donald Trump, because over $1 billion in personal debt, well, those banks that he owes it to, they can get whatever they want, because they have leverage. Okay, look, man, you want us to wipe off a couple hundred million, whatever, pass this legislation deregulating us further. Pass this legislation allowing us to keep doing tax avoidance and tax dodging, or give us a deal where we pay 3% tax on it if we bring it back in. So they have leverage, and that's not good. But now we learn, the Washington Post is reporting that Trump continued to stiff workers while he was on the campaign trail. The fucking balls on this guy. So understand that other stories leaked about him stiffing campaign workers. They leaked while he was on the campaign trail, but they were referring to, you know, years prior these things happened. So at least he has the plausible deniability for whatever it's worth, which isn't much, where he could say, yeah, that was years ago. They're saying, no, while he was on the campaign trail. So they explain here, workers from AES Electrical apparently went all out to make sure Donald Trump could open his luxury hotel on the day he wanted. In the frenzied final 6 weeks of work at the hotel, while Trump touted the project on the campaign trail, AES of Laurel, Maryland, claims it assigned 45 members of its staff to work 12-hour shifts for nearly 50 consecutive days to get the lights, electrical, and fire systems prepared on time. The Trump Organization and its construction manager, Lendlease, stopped paying AES 3 days before Christmas. AES filed a mechanics lien with the D.C. government, alleging that it was out almost $2.1 million. The AES filing brings a total of allegedly unpaid bills on the hotel to more than $5 million total. Washington area plumbing firm Joseph J. Magnolia, Inc. and Northern Virginia Construction Company, A&D Construction, are seeking $2.98 million and $79,700, respectively. So Trump said, remember recently he was bragging, oh, yes, we finished this project. We finished it on schedule and ahead of time. On schedule and ahead of time. That's what he's referring to. So, yeah, you finished it on schedule and ahead of time, kind of, sort of, but you stiffed the fucking workers who did it, who got you there. Trump 101, man. You think this guy, like, is a fucking working class, you know, hero? You fell for it. You've been had. You've been took. You've been bamboozled. There's no way. I mean, stiffing workers, paying illegal immigrants less than minimum wage. He also, while he campaigned railing against NAFTA and TPP and outsourcing, which are issues where I totally agree with his rhetoric on the campaign trail about that stuff, he outsources his own jobs, dipshit. His own jobs. He sent jobs to Turkey and Mexico and China. There's that famous interaction with Donald Trump and David Letterman on David Letterman's show, where David Letterman gets Trump started on China, where he rants and he raves and he goes on and on against China and, oh my God, currency manipulation and they're screwing us in trade and this and that and yada, yada, yada. And then David Letterman takes out one of Trump's ties and says, this is a nice tie. I think I'd wear this tie. I really like the color scheme and everything. Anyway, Don, take a look at this tie. Hold your tie for me here. Show the audience your tie. Do me a favor. Read what it says to me on the back there. He's like, made in China. Yes, of course. Because he's unmoored. He has no core philosophy. And when that's the case, you can get very good at crowd surfing and reading everybody's emotions and telling everybody in the room what they want to hear. But when push comes to shove, he's either going to act off of his authoritarian impulse behind the scenes, which we've seen him do things like that before, or what he'll do is, at times, he realizes, hey, I'm over my head, I got to defer to whoever's around me, and he picked the establishment to be around him. So it's either going to be super-duper establishment or an authoritarian, bullheaded, crazy person, or a mix of both. None of those things are good, and all the evidence points in that direction. Doom, bitch. All right, next, let's go to Trump's treatment of the media. Okay. Esquire is out with a story on how the Trump administration is planning on treating the media. They say Donald Trump's team is considering moving press conferences out of the White House briefing room where they've been held for decades in a potential change that has alarmed journalists just days before the start of the new administration. The incoming administration may evict reporters from the White House, with one unnamed senior official calling the press the opposition party. The nearby White House Conference Center or old executive office building are said to be under consideration as new locations for the briefings. The incoming press secretary has discussed no longer televising daily briefings, a practice that began in the 1990s, or even holding the briefings in a different way. He's also talked about switching up the briefing room seating arrangement, a process overseen for decades by the White House Correspondents Association. So, now, when you talk to them about this, when you talk to the administration about this, they'll go into their little tap dance. They'll say, whoa, no, don't get the wrong idea here, guys. It's not that Trump is particularly hostile to the media in a way that other presidents haven't been, even though other presidents, including Obama, have been massively hostile to the media in some respects. It's not that, though. No. We're doing it for practical reasons. Look, Donald Trump he's a big-time celebrity, okay? And that means there are a lot of other media outlets that want to cover him, not just the traditional media outlets. So we want to be even more open with the press, and we want more people to come in and cover him. So it's just not big enough anymore. You know, the room's just not big enough. So what are we going to do? We're going to just move it out of the White House. Now, if they provided sufficient evidence to show me, like, okay, no, it's not like we're going to, you know, try to hide from the media more and tell them even less information and crack down on them more. if they gave me evidence that that indeed was the case, well, then I'd be okay with it, because then it is just a case of, hey, it's practical, we want more people in the room, and, you know, we got to fit them, so what are we going to do? But there are so many lines in here that are just gigantic red flags, like when they say, the incoming press secretary has discussed no longer televising daily briefings, a practice that began in the 1990s. Or even, instead of having the room set up in the way where the journalists decide and the organizations decide, they want to pick. Oh, okay, so I see what's happening here. If you're not trying to do the daily press briefings anymore, then you're just trying to be even less transparent. If you're not talking to the media, then you're trying to hide more of what you're doing, obviously. And then if you try to schedule it and try to organize the room as you please, well, what are they going to do? All of the organizations that are the most lenient on Trump and the most in favor of Trump are going to get the front row seats and are going to get the most questions. And all the other more adversarial organizations are going to be pushed further and further to the back and become more and more irrelevant. Look, we just saw that with CNN recently. Now, in this very specific instance, I actually think CNN was wrong, because they kind of ran with a story that appears to be complete and utter bullshit. So I actually don't blame Trump and his administration for being mad at CNN in that case. But then when Trump goes out there and he gives a press conference and he doesn't even give the CNN guy a question, and he's like, you are fake news, and then he just moves along to the next one. No, bitch, you're the president of the United States. You don't get to just, you know, unilaterally and universally say, that's it, no, you're done. Because this is what he did on the campaign trail, too. On the campaign trail, he had media blacklists. I was screaming from the rooftops about this, saying, don't do that. You shouldn't even be allowed to do that. When you're running for president, you should have to abide by the same rules and laws and regulations as if you already were president. So if you want to be in the highest office in the land, you have to abide by the First Amendment when you're there, correct? Well, then when you're running for that office, why shouldn't you have to abide by the First Amendment when you're doing that? Of course you should. So you shouldn't be able to have a media blacklist that says, oh, you said something bad about me, you're not allowed to cover me. You said something bad about me, you're not allowed to cover me. So it turns out that Trump, on the campaign trail, he had kicked out organizations like, for example, the National Review, a very conservative outlet. But he said, I don't know, you're too mean to me, I don't like it, gone. The Politico, kind of vanilla centrist establishment kind of paper, gone. Washington Post, so many, just kicked them out. And who did he allow in? There were white nationalist radio shows that he would give press credentials to. But, you know, outlets that were well known that have been in business for decades and decades, who he said, no, I don't like you, so you're gone. So they're trying to craft a media that is totally and utterly subservient to the state. And this is another expression of that here. They're dodging by saying, no, it's about practical reasons. We want to allow more people in. But in essence, what they're doing is, hey, let's shut down the process. Let's not have the daily press briefings. Let's make them more rare. And when we do them, let's not have them in the White House. Let's get them more detached. And then when we do them in the other place, the new place, let's change the seating arrangement and put all of Trump's favorite outlets closer to him, and he'll probably only call on them, rarely, if ever, call on people who are going to be adversarial to him. So, look, oftentimes I get mad at the media for how they cover Trump and how they do a shitty fucking job, but this is even more concerning, to have a president who goes this far above and beyond to crack down on the media. That's in no way excusing Obama, because, you know, he's notoriously been bad with the press, and obviously with, like, whistleblowers, for example. There's a war on whistleblowers. Just talk to Edward Snowden about that. He used the Espionage Act to go after leakers, whistleblowers, who leaked to the media important information more than any other president, more than all the other presidents combined. So he was a disaster in his own respect. This is in no way excusing anything he did. What Trump is doing here, though, is above and beyond, because he's saying, we're just going to blow up the way the game is played because I don't want to be questioned. So this is that authoritarian impulse taking over, and it appears like what scares me is that everybody's already just kind of like yawning at it. Like, what are you going to do? Well, daily press briefings? How about not daily? How about maybe every other day? Or how about maybe once a week? And, doing it in the White House? No, let's detach it further. And why not let me pick the seating arrangements? Oh, boy. So buckle up. This isn't good. It's going to be a long ride. It's going to be a bumpy ride. And we need to be more adversarial now than ever and we need to make sure we hold him and his administration accountable and bring the facts to them and let them know you ain't going to get away with it if you're not being truthful. Okay. It is break time. It is break time. And when we come back, I have a report out on income inequality that you don't want to miss, and then we'll talk about MLK. We got a good segment here about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. for MLK Day. So we got that and much more. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back, bitch.
The left, you will fake, so I'm gonna grab you with the left, I feel like I'm the left. left real nigga left. The left. It's like I'm on an island by myself. The left. Please don't make me slap you with the left. The left. You will fake so I'm gonna slap you with the left.
Son of a bitch. All right, we're back.
The left real nigga left. The left.
We are back. We are back. We are back. Back, 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 back.
Okay, now buckle up for this next one because this is absolutely positively. Oh, motherfucker, the camera. Oh, of course. Of course. Stall him. Stall him, Kyle. All right, I will sing show tunes to you as I fix the camera because I'm a professional, bro. You don't think I could pull this off? You don't think I could fix the camera while talking to you live on air? Like a boss? Man, I was born for this shit. Okay, I don't think my stalling tactics are working very well. I don't know why it is, but I have this camera that, I don't know if it's the angle or whatever the fuck, but it's an issue with it staying, like, it kind of, like, creeps ever so slowly in different directions. Who knows? Whatever. And I'm a perfectionist, so I always like to have it on point. And that doesn't always happen. Sometimes, no matter how hard I try, you look at the angle after and you're like, motherfucker, how is that crooked? I spent like an hour getting it right, and then all of a sudden it looks like it's massively crooked when we're live on air. But anywho, all right, so I actually successfully did it. And now I'm back to make love to your brain down by the fire. Okay. Oxfam report. This is a absolutely ridiculous, preposterous, over-the-top, terrible story. Okay, here we go. Oxfam is out with the new report on wealth inequality that they released yesterday, and there are some astonishing facts in there. So before I get into it, let me remind you what the case was, I believe, 2 years ago when they released this report, and then last year when they released a different updated report. So now this is the third one of these that I've seen. But when you go back about 3 years, the story is just lasered into my brain and it will never leave me. Apparently, 82 people, the richest 82 people in the world, have more wealth than the bottom 50% of the world combined. Really let that soak in for a second. Let that marinate in your brain. Think of the consequences of that. 82 people, more wealth than 50% of the world. That's over 3 billion people. Now, last year's report, all of a sudden that number started dropping even more. So I think it was about 62 people. So it went from 80-something to 60-something people having more wealth than half the world. I don't know, by the way, how anybody can defend that system, as if there's any logical explanation for it that could justify it morally. But not just morally, also economically. When you have that much of a gap between the rich and the poor, or just average people and the rich, you're sowing the seeds of revolution. You're making your bed and you're going to sleep in it. Because that's so disproportionate that there's no argument for it. Certainly no convincing argument for it. So those were the reports from a few years ago. Now, let's fast forward to today and let me give you some new numbers. So they say, a top corporate CEO earns as much in 1 year as 10,000 garment factory workers in Bangladesh. 10,000 people make less than one top corporate CEO. That appears to be massively, massively unsustainable, as well as unethical and downright stupid. I got more for you. The world's 10 biggest corporations together have revenue greater than the 180 poorest countries combined. Let me repeat that. The 10 biggest corporations have revenue greater than the 180 poorest countries combined. 180. That's the overwhelming majority of countries on the planet are not as rich as the top 10 corporations. By the way, who rules the world? Think about it. Who really has the most power and the most control? A lot of people might say, hey, nation states, clearly. With a fact like this, you begin to wonder. It's more likely multinational corporations. Now, they don't have, you know, mercenary armies, for example, but when you think about the way the system works in the U.S., what happens? You have corporations pay the politicians, and the politicians do the bidding of the corporation. So they basically are renting the U.S. military to do what they want them to do. That's why there's been so many examples of wars over natural resources. I mean, go, if you haven't read about it, this stuff was happening for a long, long time. Even go back to the banana wars. Read about the banana wars. How banana companies in the U.S. wanted to jack bananas from South America because they wanted to take them and then make money off them. So we invaded them. But it's not just that. This still happens to this day. Wars over natural resources and power and control. And it's not like, you know, we really are, oh, the moral world policeman and we're making rational decisions based on human rights. Really? Then why are we allies with Saudi Arabia? A terrorist state that has the same ideology as ISIS. Because it's not about human rights and altruism and trying to do the right thing and be the world police. Oftentimes, our government acts as, you know, and the military acts as the thugs for multinational corporations, and they end up doing their bidding. And I'm not saying they even know that that's what they're doing and, you know, they're bad people. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is when you look at the incentive structure in the system and you have corporations pay the government and the government does favors for the corporations, I mean, it's all laid out right in front of you. Now, I still haven't gotten to the biggest fact yet. So remember, it was 80-some-odd people had more wealth than half the world. Then it was 62. What's the number today? 8. 8 men now own the same amount of wealth, so it would be 9 people to surpass it, as the poorest half of the world. See, this is why the idea of conservatism drives me nuts. Because conservatism, one of the definitions of conservatism, to be fair, because there are various definitions, but one of them is, look, man, we're traditionalists. We think things are basically more or less okay. So we kind of want to keep things as they are. We don't want to rock the boat too much. We don't want to do too much change. We don't want to have too much progress. Because we're already kind of comfortable, so pump your brakes here. That's one of the ideas of conservatism, one of the definitions of conservatism. But how can anybody, knowing this fact, say, I'm a conservative, or I'm that kind of a conservative? That is logically impossible. Like, you could look at that and go, you know what? I think that's the proper way we should do it. I think 8 people should have the same amount of wealth as half the fucking world, or 9 people should have more wealth than half the world. The main point here is, all your life, you've been told, by well-meaning people, I'm not trying to put these people down, I'm sure they're lovely people, as a matter of fact, but, hey, the way it works, it's very simple. You keep your head down, you keep grinding, you keep working hard, you're going to get where you want to go. Now, in some instances, there's a grain of truth to that. But in most cases, there's no truth in that. Because I just told you the numbers. Do you think that these 8 people or 9 people somehow are just that much better human beings? They're just that much superior to you. They work that much harder that they deserve. 9 people deserve more wealth than the bottom 3.6 billion. No, they didn't work that much harder. They're not that much better than you. They happen to be in a system that rewards them financially and allows them to pass down wealth financially in a way that's obscene. So the answer is, we got to redistribute. Anybody who's not in favor of redistribution, like, it's funny, the conservatives use that as like a smug, like, dismissal of, literally, like, oh, yeah, that guy, he's in favor of wealth redistribution. If you read this and you're not in favor of wealth redistribution, you're an idiot. And nobody is saying, because now is when they start strawmanning, no, okay, so you want everybody to have the exact same amount, huh? No, dipshit, I didn't say that. Nobody said that. Nobody's saying the person who runs a giant organization who works 15-hour days should make the same as the part-time janitor who comes there and cleans up every now and then. Nobody's saying that. You made it up. So we understand that, and I certainly understand that some level of a meritocracy is okay. But in order to have a meritocracy and say, hey, the harder you work, the further you go, you need to have a baseline where everybody starts the race from. So you need to have a social safety net. You need to have a system that allows a bare minimum standard of living that then allows people to compete on an equal footing. And we simply don't have that. And as I already told you, this isn't even a meritocracy, because a lot of the richest people in the world, it's inheritance. It's passed down from their uber-rich granddaddy who did whatever, and then they have the wealth, and then they pass it down. And you have many Paris Hiltons who they sit around with their thumb up their ass all day, and they somehow still think they're better than you. No, we need a social democratic system the world over. That's the answer. I'm not calling for doing it in an international way, so I'm not calling for NWO, New World Order, you know, one world government. I'm not calling for that at all. I think you should, you know, shrink it down to the nation-state level, and people should do it within their own borders, basically. But when you read facts like this, you understand that all the arguments made to perpetuate the inequalities of the system are just utter trash. So don't tell me we can't do single-payer healthcare in the United States of America. Don't tell me that. When the richest 9 people in the world have more wealth than the bottom 50% of the world, 3.6 billion. Don't tell me we can't do single-payer health care. Don't tell me we can't do free college. Don't tell me we can't set up a system that pays a living wage. If you work full-time, you should make enough money to survive. The answers seem pretty clear. And we would be happy if this just came down to a reasonable number. But we're so far away from that which is reasonable, and I'll say it again. They are sowing the seeds of their own destruction. Because when you have inequality to this extent, the downsides are immense. I mean, we saw it, during the Great Depression. It's not just bad for regular people, which of course it is, but it's not just bad for them. It's also bad for these rich people, because back during the Great Depression, or right before the crash, right before the stock market collapsed in the Great Depression, the top 1% of earners in the U.S. were making 24% of the income. 1% of people pulling in basically a quarter of the economic pie. Well, that's unsustainable, because what happened? Then your average person didn't have the money to buy the goods that the so-called captains of industry, the rich people, were making. So the system stopped, the system grind to a halt. And then what happened? When FDR came in and did the New Deal and did redistribution of wealth and regulated Wall Street, all of a sudden the income that the top 1% was making, it fell. It fell to about 12% of the economic pie. And it led to stability. When you had a more equitable distribution of the wealth, the system chugs along better. The system stays healthy. So, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, and this is appropriate for today because it's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we're not just trying to liberate the oppressed here. We're trying to liberate the oppressor, too. Because obviously the 3.6 billion people, poorest people in the world, having less than the top nine people, more than half the fucking world. That ain't just bad for them. It's bad for those top nine people, too. It's bad for the rich. Because if we don't do this in an organized, structured way, where we create systems that foster equal opportunity, well, then guess what? People are going to start pouring into the streets with pitchforks and torches and guns. And you don't want that. So this kind of predatory corporate capitalism the world over, corporatism, this is the cancer that needs to die. And we need to get money out of the political system, not just in the U.S., but everywhere in the world where corruption is a big deal, and it's an even bigger deal in many other countries. But you need to end the corruption, do clean elections, and then push for social democratic systems. Because if you don't, the unrest is going to bubble up and bubble up more and bubble up more, and then we're facing a really, really dystopian future. And I haven't even touched on the issue of automation yet. Because with automation and the workforce shrinking and moving more towards basically robots and machines to do the work, well, guess what? Then you're going to have even more pissed off people, people making even less money, a higher unemployment rate, and you're going to have further stratification and the rich getting even more rich when the numbers are already beyond preposterous. Nine people, more than 50% of the world. They didn't just work harder. They're not just better people. They're functioning in a system that says your economic value is equal to your human value. That's the system we have. Your economic value is equal to your human value. Well, I say hell no, because there's no goddamn way that nine people, you can count them on two fucking hands, man, having more than half the world, really those nine people are just better people. Their human value is worth more than 3.6 billion human beings on the planet. I got news for you. Those people have kids too. Those people are aunts and uncles. Those people are grandmas and grandpas. Those people have their own life stories. Those people matter. Those people count. The system we have right now doesn't recognize that. It's time to fight back so we do recognize that. Okay. Now let's talk about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Here we go. On MLK Day, I want to remind you how he was viewed at the time, because we often forget. So I want to show you this short clip here from Fusion, and then we're going to come back and break it down.
Most know Martin Luther King for his I Have a Dream speech, but that doesn't paint the whole picture. King didn't just preach a message of anti-racism. He also fought against U.S. imperialism abroad and income inequality domestically. He was seen as such a threat to power that Bobby Kennedy authorized the FBI to wiretap him for 5 years. Why did those in power want to monitor Martin Luther King? Well, the official reason was to see if he had any ties to the communists. But the FBI kept the wiretaps going even after they found nothing to suggest that King had any ties to the Soviet Union or the Communist Party. Instead, the FBI focused on King's private sex life in a failed attempt to discredit his radical message. It's easy to overlook how radical Martin Luther King's message was, even by today's standards. Listen to what he said about a universal basic income.
One of the answers, it seems to me, is a guaranteed annual income, a guaranteed minimum income.
Universal basic income is an idea that's gaining some traction these days, but it's still on the fringes of political discourse. He also pushed other ideas that few public figures would touch today, like a redistribution of wealth. And he called the United States the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. So it's no surprise that Martin Luther King was widely hated by people in power at the time. In 1963, John F. Kennedy said this about him.
Martin Luther King is the king of smoke.
Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Johnson, reportedly had these nice words to say about Martin Luther King. I'll just let you read it, because there's no way I'm saying that on camera. No, I'm not saying it. I'm not touching that. And this was the guy who signed the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Act. And think about what other people in the government must have been saying about him. But perhaps the most infamous incident was the letter sent to Dr. King by the FBI in which they threatened to expose his sexual affairs unless he stepped aside. The letter has some truly insane passages, such as, "Satan could not do more. What incredible evil is. It's all there on the record, your sexual orgies. Listen to yourself, you filthy, abnormal animal.
The establishment absolutely despised MLK. It wasn't even close. Wasn't even close. And as they laid out there, even the good guys despised him. So when you talk about Lyndon B. Johnson, yeah, he signed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. He did the war on poverty. So in some ways, he actually wasn't even a bad president. Obviously, Vietnam was a disaster, and he escalated that. But it was the guns and butter policy. The butter part was good. JFK, often views, oh my God, so liberal. He's so liberal, he's so progressive. He's one of the best presidents ever. Well, he was escalated in Vietnam. He also, by the way, did covert actions in Cuba to try to topple them and make it a puppet state again of the U.S. So he wasn't as liberal as everybody thought. And then you heard him talking about MLK right there. I don't want that guy in the White House. I don't know what he's talking about. So, and those are the good guys. Imagine what, you know, the real, real Southern Dixiecrats. To be fair, Lyndon Johnson was a Dixiecrat, but he famously said when he signed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, the Democratic Party is losing the South for a generation right now. Because he knew the Democratic Party, so the Democratic Party in the South, the Dixiecrats, those were conservative Democrats who were openly racist and openly pro-segregation. So he knew, well, I'm going to sign this bill and give black people equal rights. Well, they're going to lose. They're never going to vote for Democrats again. And that is more or less what happened. But imagine what they were saying about MLK. You got to understand, it wasn't an uncommon thing for people to call him a terrorist for nonviolently, peacefully protesting for equal opportunity and justice. And then you saw the rest of it. Oftentimes, people like to try to, you know, cleanse the rest of his message and spruce it up for a modern audience where they go, no, see, this whole thing was just, racial justice and equality. That's all it is. So don't even, in many ways, he's actually really conservative. This article that came out the other day, they do this every MLK, that he was a true conservative. Well, only if you, you know, lump into the bin of conservatism being massively anti-Vietnam, calling the U.S. government the greatest purveyor of violence, saying inequality in healthcare is the worst kind of inequality, so he was in favor of a universal healthcare system, calling for a universal basic income, a living wage. He was assassinated while protesting with unions to try to get a better deal and better working conditions and better wages. So, no, perhaps the only thing he was conservative on was the LGBTQ community, because at that time, unfortunately, that was the overwhelming consensus in the country among everybody on the political spectrum. So, but outside of that, the dude was a crusader on behalf of working people, and he famously said, look, I'm not just fighting to liberate the oppressed. I'm fighting to liberate the oppressor. I have love for my enemies because I know that if you're holding people down, keeping them second-class citizens, oftentimes quite literally lynching them, you have hate in your heart. And that hate means you not only do you not love other people, you don't love yourself. You're in your own mental chains. So I'm not just here to liberate the oppressed. I'm here to liberate the oppressor. And that's why his message of nonviolent resistance was so strong, because it worked. It worked. You won in the realm of public opinion over time because you took the moral high ground and you fought from a position of justice. So you didn't revert to the tactics of the savages you were opposing. I'm going to repeat that. You didn't revert to the tactics of the savages you were opposing. So they use violence. They try to crack down. If you had used it, well, then all of a sudden you muddy the moral waters and people go, I don't know, they did violence and they did violence. What am I going to say? What am I going to do? Maybe they're equally bad. Who knows? But no, not only was your value system and your ideology correct, the things you were fighting for, but your goals in trying to achieve it, or the process that you took in trying to achieve it, the means, the method, That was accurate. That was spot on. And you kept the moral high ground the entire time. And then when people look back and they see the Alabama sheriffs turning the water hoses and the dogs on the peaceful protesters, they go, this isn't even close. We have a picture of pure good and pure evil right in front of us. The Alabama sheriffs are the pure evil. The black protesters and the liberal protesters are correct. They are correct. And history over time said, you know what? We can't lie to ourselves here. That guy's right. These people were wrong. So let's not just limit it, though, to what he was talking about with race. Because that's what we say now. Oh, obviously the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, that was correct, except the Supreme Court obviously said, I don't know about that. Let's roll back the Voting Rights Act, because what are you saying? Mississippi is more racist than New York? How crazy are you? No, that's exactly what it is. Of course that's what it is. How do you not see that? But let's also remember, the guy was fighting for a living wage. The guy was fighting for a universal basic income. The guy was fighting for a free healthcare system. The guy was out there saying the U.S. is an imperialist government. My government is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. We are killing massive numbers of innocent brown people, and we got to stop it. Now, what's funny is you have Malcolm X, who, when Malcolm X was younger, he was more extreme than MLK. He believed more in violence. But to be fair to him, he always maintained, I'm only talking about violence for self-defense. But as he got older, as Malcolm X got older, he became more like MLK. And MLK, when he was younger, was probably even softer on all the issues compared to when he got older, he moved a little bit more in the direction of Malcolm X. So it was, at the end, there was this kind of meeting of they both more or less shared the same philosophy and the same process to achieve it. So you had MLK talking more not just about racial justice, but also talking about economic justice, justice in foreign policy to stop imperialism. And you had Malcolm X, who when he was younger called for separation from the U.S. and black nationalism, to basically have the U.S. give a certain portion of land to black people and say, this is basically reparations, you have your own state. And he says it's not segregation, it's separation, because segregation is imposed from a ruling class on an underclass. Separation is two equals mutually deciding to split. He said, let's split and let's have a black nation in the U.S. As he got older, he moved away from that. And he moved more towards, you know, let's have the multicultural melting pot society and let's move towards justice in that way, in a more MLK sense. So at the end, you kind of had this meeting of the minds, but there's no question that, look, he's one of my heroes. I can't tell you countless nights I've spent watching MLK speeches, Malcolm X speeches, and you have to understand that the way to honor the legacy is not just to do, you know, whatever, celebrate it once a year, you get a day off from work, and you watch TV. The way to honor their legacy is to continue the fight, because if Martin Luther King Jr. or Malcolm X was around today, they would be the first ones out there saying, oh, we're going to fight for a living wage. We're going to fight to end all these wars. We're going to fight probably for free college. We're going to take all these progressive priorities which try to foster a system with equal opportunity, and we're going to get it. And I'm sure they would continue on to fight for racial justice. So, for example, with all the police shootings of unarmed black people, I'm sure they would say, all right, we're going to do reform. We're going to, for example, try to get body cameras on all the police officers across the country. At a federal level, you pass a bill like that. We're going to get special prosecutors so that instead of somebody who's the buddy of the police officer who murdered an innocent black person, instead of that person trying to bring them up on trial, because they'll throw the case, obviously, as they've done multiple times, we'll get special prosecutors to do it. And there are so many ways to address these problems that are real. Ending the drug war would overnight cut down on not just the injustice against everybody, but definitely the injustice in a racial sense, too, because the drug war is used disproportionately to crack down on minority communities. So there are so many concrete steps that can be taken to make a better world when it comes to race relations and to make a better world when it comes to justice for everybody, economic justice, justice in foreign policy, that our work is not done and it's never done. So we need to pick up the mantle and keep running with it, because we got to leave a legacy behind too, our generation. And, you know, we could be the generation that gets money out of politics and ends the over-the-top corruption which has bought our government and made it the disaster it is. It's the problem that births all other problems, money in politics and corruption. We can get a constitutional amendment to end that. We can get a single-payer system. We can get a free college bill. We can make the minimum wage a living wage and tie it to inflation. So the work's not done, and we got to keep running forward, and let's do it in the name of a great man like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Okay. Now, we go to a story about, well, actually, you know, I'm going to jump ahead here. Let me do the Obamacare story, because this is important. Somebody who uses Obamacare asked a question to Paul Ryan during his CNN town hall recently, and I wanted to share it with you.
I was a Republican, and I worked for the Reagan and Bush campaigns. Just like you, I was opposed to the Affordable Care Act. When it was passed, I told my wife we would close our business before I complied with this law. Then, at 49, I was given 6 weeks to live with a very curable type of cancer. We offered three times the cost of my treatment, which was rejected. They required an insurance card. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, I'm standing here today alive. Being both a small business person and someone with pre-existing conditions, I rely on the Affordable Care Act to be able to purchase my own insurance. Why would you repeal the Affordable Care Act without a replacement?
Oh, we wouldn't do that. We want to replace it with something better. First of all, I'm glad you're standing here. I mean, really, seriously.
Can I say one thing? I hate to interrupt you. Can I say one thing? I want to thank President Obama from the bottom of my heart, because I would be dead if it weren't for him.
That is such a great clip, because it shows how off the spectrum Republicans are today. So understand something about Obamacare. We've brought this up time and time and time again, and I still don't think many people know it. But the heart of Obamacare is what's called the individual mandate, which is, to its core, a right-wing idea. So Richard Nixon had proposed a similar plan for health care. Bob Dole in 1996, who ran against Clinton. Bob Dole was the Republican. He proposed a similar plan to this when he ran. The Heritage Foundation, which is a right-wing think tank, they wrote policy papers laying out in detail their philosophy, which was very similar to this plan, the idea of the individual mandate. Newt Gingrich supported something similar to it. Chuck Grassley, these are deeply, deeply, deeply conservative Republicans and establishment conservative Republicans. So that was their response to the liberal bill. The liberal bill, of course, is single payer. That's the idea of the government is the single insurer, and the for-profit company shouldn't be in control. It should be, you know, you basically you're born and you have health care immediately, and you never don't have it because it comes out of your tax dollars. There's a percentage of your income tax that goes to health care, and you never have to worry about paying for health care. It's what virtually every other modern nation does. So instead of getting a single-payer system or a public option, when Obama had a supermajority, he caved all the way to the Republican idea, which was the individual mandate. Now, the Republicans, in their eternal obstinance and obstructionist mindset, they said, wrong, now we disagree with our own bill and our own proposals because you're proposing it. And then they came up with all these nonsense arguments, you want our grandmas to die, you know, you're horrible, you have death panels, and this is socialism. It is quite literally the opposite of a socialist bill. I wish that Obama did single payer, which is a socialist bill. So they turned and did an about face on their own legislation. So now they got nowhere to go. The Democrat did your idea. And let me be clear about something. Was Obamacare better than what we had before? Yes! Yes! Our system was so immensely, colossally bad that any reform would have been good reform. Any reform at all. And that's what we got with Obamacare. We got 30 million more people covered. There were some good provisions in Obamacare like, hey, pre-existing conditions. You know, the companies can't reject you for that anymore. The companies have to keep kids on their parents' rolls if the parents choose until they're 26 years old. It used to be a lot lower than that. The ratio that the companies can spend on care went up. It used to be like some companies had 50-50. They spend 50% of the money that they get on healthcare, 50% on overhead and paperwork and nonsense. Now it's like 80% or something like that. So it's better than nothing. But that's how far the spectrum has shifted to the right, where the Democratic Party does the Republican idea, and the Republicans are in favor of complete and utter anarcho-capitalism in the healthcare market, which is as bad as you could ever have it. So let the insurance companies do whatever the fuck they want to do. Don't mandate more people are covered. And it's just the wild, wild west, which means we're going to have 30 million more people uninsured, and we're going to have more than 45,000 people that die every year that don't have access to basic health care. That was the case just before Obamacare. Obamacare may have ticked that down a little bit, but now it's going to go right back up. And they're also going to get rid of probably the best provisions in Obamacare, like the Medicaid expansion, for example. You get rid of the Medicaid expansion, that means you're lowering the income threshold for Medicaid, which means you're just kicking lower middle class people off of having insurance, and then they're not going to go get care when they need it, and they're going to die. In fact, we've covered stories about that where people die. Now, here you have somebody, I'm a Republican, I'm a small business owner, I hated Obamacare. Guess what? It saved my life. And what's Paul Ryan's response? Well, you know, I'm happy you're alive. Really? Your voting record would not indicate that. The voting record of every single Republican in Congress wouldn't indicate that because they all voted against Obamacare. So talk is cheap, Paul. Talk is very, very, very cheap. You know what matters in politics? Policy. Your voting record. And your voting record says to this guy, drop dead. And you're about to make that same message crystal clear again. Because as we covered, the Republicans are coming for Obamacare with a fucking sledgehammer. So this shows you how off the spectrum the Republican Party is. And let me be clear about something. They're so off the spectrum that they make Donald Trump look reasonable. There are times when the mainstream Republican Party makes Donald Trump look like Noam Chomsky. How can I not say his name when I know all about him? They make Donald Trump at times look like Noam Chomsky. When Trump goes out there and says, we're going to do an infrastructure bill. We're going to rebuild America. We're going to do an infrastructure bill. We're going to fix the infrastructure. We're going to stop doing all these wars. We're going to stop doing them, and it's going to be tremendous, believe me. We're going to not cut Social Security. We're going to not cut Medicare. That's what's going to happen. We're not going to cut it. It's not going to happen. Big Pharma is getting away with murder. We're going to crack down on Big Pharma. That's what we're going to do. Now, he always contradicts himself. But at least half the time he says shit like that, you don't hear anything like that from any of the other mainstream Republicans. Paul Ryan, not in a million years, would say something like that. He's trying to cut Medicare right now. He's trying to cut Social Security right now. So this is how off the spectrum these lunatics are, and they control every level of government. God help us all. In some instances, Donald Trump is our only hope to not get the most draconian bills passed. And I don't want to rely on that guy for dick. So that sounded really creepy. I don't want to rely on him for dick. Jokes aside, we're so off the spectrum on the right-wing side, and the answer is we need real Democrats, principled Democrats, who aren't corporatist Democrats, who aren't establishment Democrats. We need Democrats who are progressive. We need Democrats who are liberal. We need Democrats who are from the Bernie wing of the party to rise up, pull the spectrum back to a place where it's reasonable, block all the unraveling that's going to happen and also take us in the right direction with the right policies. Okay. Now, if you can't tell, we're not doing a second break, because that's how we roll. How I roll like a G, dog. All right. Now, we move along to Cory Booker. Let's bust this fool up again. Ben Norton tweeted an article in the midst of Cory Booker selling out to Big Pharma and Twitter learning that Cory Booker is doing that. So all of the principled left on Twitter just unleashed holy hell on Cory Booker's head, which is exactly what I wanted to see. And this article that Ben Norton tweeted really is a reminder of who Cory Booker is. So the article is from 2013. It's on CNBC.com, and it's titled, "Hedge Funders Couldn't Be Happier About This Politician." Of course, referring to Cory Booker. So they say this: "A new senator is coming to Washington, and hedge fund managers couldn't be more excited. Democrat Cory Booker beat Republican challenger Steve Lonergan in a special election this week to represent New Jersey in the U.S. Senate. Booker, now the mayor of Newark, has received financial support from some of the biggest names in investing. Hedge funders helped Booker crush Lonergan in fundraising. Booker collected $11.2 million to Lonergan's $1.35 million as of October 4th, according to the Star Ledger. Their reasons appear varied, but at least two specific policy points likely guided their cash to the charismatic former Rhodes Scholar. Booker's focus on education reform and support for Israel." So two beliefs where Cory Booker is openly right-wing. Apparently he's in favor of all these private schools, and he hates public schools, and he reflexively sides with Israel over the Palestinians, even when Israel does their bomb fests in Gaza, where Netanyahu kills minimum 80% civilians, including over 500 children. Cory Booker, Mr. Principled Liberal Democrat over here, he goes, "Oh, dead kids, dead women and children, bombing civilians, taking out hospitals and schools and the only power plant in Gaza. What are you, an anti-Semite for calling that out? How dare you? I'm on the side of Israel." Now, here's the real reason why the hedge funds were ecstatic, and we learned about it recently. We've known it for a while now, to be fair. Cory Booker is a puppet. That's what he is. There's no question. It's not up in the air. "Oh, I don't know. What do you mean, Cory Booker? Well, he's a Democrat. He's got a D by his name. He must be good, right?" Wrong. Bernie Sanders proposed an amendment to cut the price of U.S. pharmaceuticals massively by importing them from Canada. Cory Booker voted against it. He voted against it because he took $300,000 from the pharmaceutical industry, and the way politics works is I scratch your back, you scratch mine. So New Jersey has a bunch of pharmaceutical companies there. He doesn't want to piss off one of his key donors in his state. So, hey, if I got to vote the other direction and make it so that medication costs double, sometimes triple, sometimes more than that, here as it does in Canada, it is what it is. And you might have to die because you can't afford your fucking medication because Cory Booker's got to get more campaign contributions from the pharmaceutical company, and he's got to be a loyal little puppet. And then he does the grotesque dodge where he tries to pull the wool over everybody's eyes or tries to convince himself so he can fucking sleep at night. "No, the only reason I voted against it is because the FDA, it's not meeting FDA standards. So what are you going to do? You got to have, if you had a provision that said, okay, FDA standards, well, then I'd vote for it." Oh, please, Cory. The standards and regulations in Canada are even more strict than in the U.S. Where's the epidemic of people dropping dead in Canada from bad medication? It doesn't exist. You made it up. So they have stronger regulations. By the way, a lot of the drugs that we're talking about here are made in the U.S. and then shipped to Canada. So we're making them here anyway. So So the idea is to get the same medication for cheaper because, you know, some people actually care about the American people and don't want them dying and don't want them going broke paying for fucking medicine. But you're a loathsome scumbag Wall Street sellout and Big Pharma sellout and just sellout across the board, so you can't help yourself. You have to vote against the people while simultaneously fishing for praise because he's sick. The next day he gives a speech, you know, we can't repeal the Affordable Care Act because what about the people? What about the people whose lives are being saved by the Affordable Care Act? We can't get rid of it. You just voted to make the medication for those people significantly more costly. That's going to have effects, Corey. Some people might die, Corey. Some people might go broke as a result of that, Corey. How disgusting are you to grandstand a day after you stab regular people in the back? And this was also a day after he testified against Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So Jeff Sessions is trying to become Attorney General. It was apparently unprecedented that a sitting senator testifies against another senator. There was a gentleman's agreement that, oh, no, if it's one of my colleagues and it's a senator, I will not testify against them. He's like, you know what, I'm going to testify against him. So he thought he bought the brownie points to get away with, now I'm going to stab the American people in the back by voting to keep their prescription drug costs higher. He thought he bought enough brownie points, and he thought he bought a news cycle where that wouldn't come up. What do you mean? No. Give me praise. I just spoke against Jeff Sessions. That'd be bad. Bad Republican, right? I spoke against him because I care so much about liberal values and the people. And that's so. Don't even look at the fact that I voted to stab people in the back on drug prices. You're sick, Corey. Don't come around here with your bullshit. Go home. It's over. It's done. You're not going to be president of the United States. You pissed off every single principled progressive in the country with that vote. So you think you have a shot? There was a corporate Democrat bigger than you, more popular than you, an A-list celebrity whose turn it was who got beat because she was a corporate Democrat. The same people that were pissed at Hillary Clinton for being Hillary Clinton and her abysmal record, they're the same people that you just pissed off. Guess what? You can't win an election without those people, bitch. So, like I said, go home. Go home. You're lucky if you win again in New Jersey. You probably will. But for president of the United States, you would get so walloped and destroyed and crushed in a Democratic primary that I actually kind of want to see it. So bring it on, because not on my fucking watch. I'll come out here and rip you every single goddamn day because you're a soulless bastard. And all the other progressive media outlets will do the same. And you're so bad at this that even mainstream outlets have to cover how smarmy and slimy and gross you are. So go home. We're done with your soulless standard politician ways. That day is done. It's a new era in American politics. Okay. Okay, now let's move on to a surprise move from Obama. A big surprise came from the Obama administration last week. The U.S. government will no longer automatically extend residency to Cuban migrants arriving in the country without visas. So for those of you who don't know, the way it worked with Cuba for a very long time is we were so against the Cuban government that we were trying to fuck them over in any imaginable way. So we said, anybody from Cuba who happens to get here to the U.S., you immediately have citizenship. There's no process, no nothing. You're just a citizen immediately. So anybody who comes from Cuba is by definition a refugee, and you can stay here forever. So Obama said the following: by taking this step, we are treating Cuban migrants the same way we treat migrants from other countries. The Cuban government has agreed to accept the return of Cuban nationals who have been ordered removed, just as it has been accepting the return of migrants found at sea. So one of the reasons he did this is because as soon as the U.S. and Cuba opened up relations and got back on a reasonable footing as opposed to permanently being at a standoff with the embargo and, hey, fuck you, and So when you put all that aside and you say, you know what, let's open up the lines of communication and let's work things out here, well, a lot of people in Cuba were like, I'm out, bitch, and they went to the U.S. because they all, a lot of them said, I want to live there, I don't want to live here anymore. So there was this giant influx of people coming from Cuba who get the citizenship like that. So Obama's like, okay, little weird, and it's a lot of people, so now we're just going to make it like if you come from Cuba, it's like you come from anywhere else. So we're not saying, no, we're not accepting anybody from Cuba, and none of you could be American citizens, but now you're just treating Cuba like every other nation. And what's the Republican response to this? Flipping out. How dare you? All of a sudden, for the first time ever, the Republican Party is like, refugees, immigrants, oh, what are you talking about? We love immigrants, we love refugees. Oh, do you really? Please. What a joke that is. They're the only ones they care about are Cuban. Because they say, oh, no, communists. See, they're escaping big bad communism. So if they come here, then they could stay. So in your estimation, the government of Cuba is worse than Saudi Arabia? Talk to them. Hey, would you take Saudi refugees like that, give them immediate citizenship? Hell no. No, no, no. Saudi Arabia is a great country. So I don't know. Why would we? It's not like they have a worse situation living in Saudi Arabia than people do in Cuba. Yeah, they do. but see, the way it works is communism bad. So if you come here, well, we'll give you freedom, freedom. Wahhabi theocracy, ISIS style. What do you mean they're our ally? If you come here from there, you got to go back. Go back. Get beheaded for doing sorcery or witchcraft or smuggling in drugs or being an atheist because you're a terrorist by definition in Saudi Arabia if you're an atheist. What a joke the Republicans are. You're just so unmoored from reality and so goofy. Yes, you should treat Cuba like any other nation when it comes to the immigration process. Of course, that's such a given and such an obvious thing. Now, again, so they would argue, well, look, it's about need. So that's how we want to prioritize it. Need, that's it. We want to be humanitarian. We want to care about the most persecuted people in the world, the Cuban people. Wrong. So if you really wanted to prioritize based on need, who would you prioritize coming in the country? For example, the Rohingya Muslim community in Myanmar. You know, countless reports from human rights bodies saying they may be the most persecuted people in the world. They're in literal camps. So, and it's the Buddhist majority, the right-wing Buddhist majority that are cracking down on the Rohingya Muslims. So should you prioritize them when they're one of the most persecuted peoples in the world? They would never do that because they're Muslim. How about Syria? Now, I'm not saying you don't vet. I'm in favor of vetting, of course. But, you know, shouldn't you prioritize them over anybody else because there's a fucking civil war that's been going on endlessly and the death count is through the fucking roof and people don't want to die? They're under assault by fucking ISIS and Al-Qaeda. You know, maybe there's some good people there who don't want to join Al-Qaeda or ISIS and don't want to be slaughtered by them or by the government. No, of course, Syria. They don't want anybody from Syria. What about the Congo? Or what about, again, Saudi Arabia or Palestine? Oh, you know, we want to prioritize based on need. Cuban people need it. Really? Do they need it more than Palestinians? As Netanyahu continues to take more and more Palestinian land, build more and more settlements, reload, and he's armed to the teeth, and he's ready to crack down any given second, and he cuts the grass every now and then, every few years, go in there and massacre a few thousand civilians, minimum 80% civilian death rate in 2014. You know, maybe to help some Palestinians? No. They're Muslim, and they're Palestinian, and we love Israel, and no, you can't do that. But Cuba, yeah, you live in Cuba, where we are in favor of you immediately getting citizenship. No, have them part of the same fucking process. And yet you actually should prioritize based on need when it comes to refugees. But that would mean Cuba would not be on the top of the list. I'm not saying they're good, so take your straw man and shove it right back up your fucking ass. I'm not saying they're good. I'm saying when you prioritize the world over, Cuba's not on the top of the list for need when we talk about refugees. Okay. Let's continue, motherfucker. We have not much time left. We have 5 minutes left. Okay. I'm going to do one more. That's what's going to happen. And then we're done. Florida State Representative Kristen Jacobs, a Democrat, is apparently one of the dumbest and most ignorant politicians in the country. She said some embarrassing things to FloridaPolitics.com recently. She proposed a bill to ban kratom, which is, of course, the harmless substance that helps addicts, and it's used recreationally, and it helps some people with PTSD, and some people with depression, and some people with anxiety, and the list is fucking endless. It's kind of like marijuana in that respect. So she proposed this in Florida, and here's what she said. The kratom industry has a story, quote, just like Hitler believed, if you tell a lie over and over again, it becomes the truth. Kratom is a scourge on society. The Kratom Association stands to lose a lot of money if they aren't able to continue profiting off the misery of addicts. How come pharmacies don't sell it? How come GNC doesn't sell it? How many more are going to die? Here's the Huffington Post answer to that. Quote, there don't appear to be records of any deaths solely attributable to kratom in Florida or anywhere for that matter. Again, just like marijuana, people are dying in the streets. Really? Show me where they're dying in the streets. Ah, people are dying in the streets. I get that you're saying that, but where's the evidence? Show me them. Ah, come on, bro. People are dying in the streets. That's not a thing. That's not a fucking thing. That's not a thing. The only time anybody's ever died with kratom in their system is when it's mixed with like three or four other drugs that are much more potent and much more toxic than fucking kratom. Thank you very much. So she also says, I love how, I mean, this is why I say she's one of the most ignorant and one of the most stupid politicians in the country, is because she said, how come pharmacies don't sell it? How come GNC doesn't sell it? As if things at GNC or at the pharmacy are by definition safe and good. You know at the pharmacy they have OxyContin, right? You know that actually leads to overdose death, right? I just spit all over the places I said that. But I am angry, so it is okay. So, and GNC, like, we covered stories about how, you know, Vitamin Shop, GNC at the grocery store, all, like, the supplements, those are unregulated by the FDA, and they've done studies where they take a whole bunch of them, and they open up the capsules, and they pour the powder out, and they test it. In many instances, it's just filler. It's just, like, chopped up wheat. It's not even the shit that they say is in it. And furthermore, even if it was the shit they say is in it, a lot of the things are totally unsourced and things that haven't been studied. Like, oh, this thing helps depression. Well, no, that's not true. But even if that was true, the product that's actually in the capsule is not what it says it is. So there's so much more fuckery going on there than in the kratom industry. Now, look, I think kratom should be regulated. Like anything else, it should be regulated. But kratom, of course, should be legal. Of course it should be legal. You know how I know? I take it all the time. I take it recreationally because it's awesome. Because, if you take a higher dose of it, it makes you feel kind of relaxed. It's kind of like a sedative, so you take it at the end of a long day. You want to chill out, watch some TV, whatever. You take a lower dose of it, it acts more of like a stimulant. He says, and if incorrectly, it's an opiate. It's not an opiate. That's not true. That is factually wrong. It acts on the same receptors, but it's not an opiate. Again, no overdose death from it, deaths from it, no deaths, period. So when it comes to actual opiates, you take too much, it slows your breathing down, you die. You take too much kratom, you throw it up. That's it. That's it. So take it from somebody who uses it and uses it fairly regularly. It is no different than having a casual drink every now and then or having some caffeine. The downsides are not very down. It's done nothing but been a benefit to somebody like me and other people I know, same thing. So this is garbage. This is nonsense. This person has no fucking idea what they're talking about, and they're anti-freedom. Keep it real. They're anti-freedom. So if somebody wants to drink coffee, go ahead. You want to drink alcohol, go ahead. But oh, no, marijuana or kratom, we should lock you up and throw away the fucking key. You really invoked Hitler while talking about Kratom. And by the way, I'm even underselling how good Kratom is, because I'm just somebody who uses it recreationally because it's awesome. There are people who need it because they were addicts to pills, whether it be Vicodin or Percocet or whatever, or they were heroin addicts. And then Kratom helps them massively, and it has saved lives. So, Kristen Jacobs, shame on you. Shame on you. You're worse than Republicans, and this is me saying it, Kyle. So, spare me. You have no clue what you're talking about, and you should honestly resign. And you, I'm going to now say it. I didn't prep this in advance. I didn't prep it in advance. I should have, but Representative Kristen Jacobs from Florida, look her up, email her, give her office a phone call. Be respectful, but tell her she's completely wrong when it comes to Kratom, and she needs to research it more, and she needs to stop being ridiculous. And if she votes like that, she's going to get voted out of office. Okay. Out of time, guys. Love you, baby. We'll see you tomorrow. You know the deal. Same time, same place. By the way, one day this week, we're doing something a little different. We're going to do another Secular Talk special. I am going to take the political ideology test. So I took I side with one during the election. I'm going to take the standard political ideology test one day this week. I haven't figured out what day yet, but one day will be that. So just a little heads up on that real quick. But we will be back tomorrow for a show. You know the deal. Much love. See you there. Mwah. Peace.